Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome back to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Birdwilt.
And we're very excited to be back with you here to discuss the first three episodes of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Perhaps I should have started off this episode by saying hello there, because we're very excited to be digging into the first half of this limited series that a lot of Star Wars fans have been waiting for years, basically. As we get into this, we're going to talk both about whether it delivered overall and then some of the, I think, really interesting new things that this show brings to the Star Wars galaxy. Let's do a little bit of an overview to give folks a sense of where we stand, what we thought in general. Grace, do you want to get us started? What were your general thoughts here on the first three episodes?
My general thoughts were cautiously positive. I feel like I've been burnt by Star Wars series before, particularly the Book of Boba Fett. You know, we had an episode about the first half of it, and then the second half of it was totally different. So I don't think that's what this show is going to do, but I feel like I can't fully judge it based on the first three episodes. So that very important caveat put out there. I think it's really fun. It's very well done. I mean, it's just a delight to see Ewan McGregor back in that role. He is just embodying Obi-Wan in a difficult part in his life so well. And the show still hasn't convinced me that it needed to exist yet. It hasn't justified its existence to me. That being said, I do think that so far it's really well done. It's interesting. I am so grateful it took us away from Tatooine and started doing some new and funky things. And I would say overall, positive thoughts.
And Haley, where you come down on the first three episodes?
I have very similar opinions. I think to the extent we're comparing this to Book of Boba Fett and sort of being burned by that, like, it seems like the story here was more thought through. And I realize that might be premature in me saying that, but it seems like, from what I can tell, like, they have a coherent plan for, like, because it's a mini series, right? It's not like they're doing seasons of this. They're doing
right. Eight
episodes to insert sort of this chapter in Obi-Wan's life. So I don't know. I have hope that it will. It seems like they're, to the extent that you want them to take the space drama about space wizards seriously, it seems like they're taking it seriously, but not in ways that, like, hobble it too much, right? Like, they have humor in there, and they have sort of, they still have character, and they're still taking some risks. So I don't know. I've enjoyed it. I feel like it's good.
I think I have the most positive impression so far. I mean, I'm really loving this. Like, I think, you know, it's a combination of, obviously, Ewan is giving an incredible performance here, but also we're getting to see this era of sort of the Empire consolidating its power, the Inquisitors going out on the prowl. We're getting to see how Obi-Wan, how Ben deals with his failure and sort of the introspection that he has committed himself to on Tatooine, and the relationship with Owen, and that's, again, kind of a really nice way of connecting us from Revenge of the Sith to A New Hope. And I think maybe we should just segue right into talking about the elephant in the room, the big kind of the shocker of that first episode that really took the series in a fascinating new direction, which is they gave us young Leia. We have young Leia here. She is kidnapped in the first episode, and that is the inciting incident that draws Obi-Wan away from Tatooine. And this, to me, to be honest with you, I think this is one of the most interesting and exciting things that Star Wars has done in a long time. It was something that, you know, as I said on Twitter after the episode came out, it's kind of one of those things that you always know in the back of your mind is theoretically possible for them to do, but you write it off because you think, oh, that's just, that's sacred ground. They're not going to touch that. They're not going to have a plan for how to do that in a way that can live up to it. And they're just going to try to avoid that and leave that alone as much as possible. Sort of like, you know, Luke in between Empire and Jedi, or Luke after Jedi, where for various reasons they just have not wanted to touch that story. We kind of write off the idea of young Leia coming into the Star Wars universe, and then when you see it, it's like you're sort of overwhelmed at first because it's like, wow, this is really happening. And then you adjust and you start watching it and sort of judging it on its merits. And I found that it was phenomenally well done. I mean, this version of young Leia that we get, she is exactly the person that I would have imagined Leia to be at this point in the story. You can see already the seeds of who she will become later in terms of the characteristics that Carrie Fisher's Leia is so well known for. I mean, she is witty at this point in her life. She is obviously very strong-willed. You know, she does what she wants. She's assertive even with, you know, adults around her. She has that sense of righteousness, that sense of right and wrong and empathy and morality and courage. All of the things that we know are going to be associated with Leia when she's a leader of the Rebel Alliance. And here we see that character, but it's not like they just de-aged Carrie Fisher, right? I mean, they didn't just sort of scale back the you know, her life and show us like an earlier version of her. This is a different take on Leia, but it's still faithful, I think, to those core tenets of who she is. And so I have to shout out Vivian Lyra Blair for just doing, I mean, yeoman's work with what has got to be one of the most difficult jobs in Star Wars that any actor has ever been given. You know, show us Carrie Fisher's Princess Leia as a kid. And she nailed it. She hit it out of the park. So that's,
she has done such a good job. And just to that point, Eric, I think the writing, like, of her lines is really, really good in the sense that, like, it's realist. Like, the questions she asks and the things she says are really realistic for what kids actually say in conversations. Like, I think Grace and I both read a sci-fi book a little while back, and there was supposed to be like an 11-year-old kid in there, and he did not speak like an 11-year-old kid. But she's like, are you my father? Like, are you even a real Jedi? Like, I just feel like the way that she has portrayed the kid, it's like they gave her, just be yourself, you know? And so I feel like that has been definitely just really well done, because there's ways not to do it well, you know. But no, she's great, definitely.
Yeah, I think this is something that they could have really easily messed up, which is part of why I think none of us thought that they would even go there, even would have this on our radar, is because it's just such a legacy character and such an easy thing to mess up that it's almost shocking that they would have her. But the way that they are using her character, I think, is really effective. I think that the actress is doing a really good job with her. She's freaking adorable. But she really has that sort of feisty, spunky spirit that Carrie Fisher definitely embodied. And we can see how she turns into that version of Leia, the self-assured Leia. And I do also think that it adds a little bit of depth to her relationship with Obi-Wan / Ben as we see it in A New Hope. I mean, she says in her little hologram, you fought with my father in the Clone Wars years ago. So I've seen a little bit of snarkiness on Reddit, like, why didn't she also mention in the hologram that also we had a great weekend together when I was 10 years old?
Yeah.
So, and I can kind of see that, but I think that it adds a nice texture to that relationship and to why she would seek him out. And also something that I think is so important that the show is very conscious about is highlighting that Leia is just as important as Luke and just as vital of a character and even a protagonist as her twin brother. And Bail even says something to that effect in the first episode, where Leia is just as important. And I really like that the show is following through on that.
Definitely. And like to that point also, like just Luke's time with Obi-Wan was so like defining for him, right? He learned so much. And just the fact that Leia sort of gets her own time and we get to see it, I've enjoyed. And we sort of have in the show notes here, I don't know which of you wrote it, but the exchange about when he's like, "Are you my dad?" And he's like, I wish I was. It was just the most like wholesome, sweetest. I have enjoyed their relationship, just like watching them.
So pure, get to know each other. Sad.
Yeah, I mean that the element of tragedy that is kind of laced into it that she doesn't fully understand, you know, makes it even more of a rich and fulfilling thing to watch. I mean, when she is kind of saying, "Listen, we got to get out of here, and we just have to trust that this is our escape route. We don't have any other choice." And he says, "You know, you remind me of someone." Obviously, a reference to Padme. I mean, that even without naming Padme, you know, that is a prequel reference. That is a way of connecting this to and honoring the prequels. And it is, I mean, I don't know that you can watch that scene without tearing up a little bit. I mean, it's really, there is Obi-Wan in the throes of this trauma and grief, remembering the life that he had, the life that he and Anakin had, and understanding in that moment that there is this through line here, that there's quite a good reason why she reminds him of Padme, but she cannot know that yet. And you know, as long as we're talking about Leia, can we talk briefly about Bail and Brea's role in her life and the glimpse that we see of that? Another thing that I think Star Wars fans kind of always assume that we would not get front and center, but here we have it in these episodes. They each have very different ways of being a parent to her, and I think it was really well done and makes a lot of sense for each of them. But I was wondering if either of you had any thoughts on what we see here in terms of the lessons that they're trying to teach her.
I think that clearly they are good parents, and I think the most fun aspect of the glimpses into their relationship is seeing how the lessons that they taught her, the different lessons they taught her, influence who she becomes. So her mother teaching her to be diplomatic and very much carry herself as a public figure, and the importance of holding herself with this kind of elegance and grace in her posture and in how she approaches life. And then her father really instilling in her this moral core while also encouraging her to explore. I think that's been really fun, and also nice to see Bail and Brea get their due as her parents, because we never really think about that aspect of her life. But just as Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru raise Luke, it was the Organas who raise Leia, and they are her parents just as much as her biological parents.
Yeah, I think that it doesn't, the show doesn't dwell on this, but it does a great job of sort of conveying this, which is that, you know, Brea is the queen. She is the ruler of this planet, and she has a lot of responsibility, and she is very insistent that her daughter be ready to replace her when the time comes. And that means teaching her, even if she doesn't want to learn, hey, this is your future. This is what it's going to be like. And so you need to get ready for this now. There's a lot of, you know, you get that kind of no-nonsense energy from her. You could tell that she loves her daughter, and you can tell that she has affection for her daughter, but she can't afford to indulge in those moments of, oh, you know, kids will be kids, right? She has a job to do, and she, and part of that job is making sure that Leia is going to be ready to do that job in the future. Bail married into this, and he has an important job, but it's not this job. And so when he's on Alderaan, he's not working in that same way as he is in the Senate. And part of that means he has a different attitude about what's going on around him, and he is able to be that more indulgent, affectionate parent, the sort of the good cop to her bad cop, of saying like, hey, listen, this is going to be your future, but there are ways for you to make this a pleasant future, not a constricting future. There are ways for you to get a lot out of this. You need to take it seriously, but you also need to continue to cultivate the empathy that you are displaying and the compassion that you're displaying, because those are important qualities to have in a leader. And so he kind of, you know, reassures her basically that, you know, we are not expecting you to purge yourself of those instincts. We want you to care about people, but we want you to sort of balance that with the need to be a dignified, sort of regal presence. And I just really like how you can understand why each of them plays the role that they play in her life. And I just love the scene where he's reassuring her, you are an Organa, you are part of this family, don't let anybody ever tell you otherwise. It's just this delightful Jimmy Smits moment, and he is just so good in this show.
I do think that as much as I have loved our little discussion of Leia and her really great portrayal in this, we did kind of skip over how the main character himself, the titular character Obi-Wan Kenobi, is presented in the show and the role that he's playing. Because I think it's such an interesting choice to have him between Revenge of the Sith, when he's this confident, sassy Jedi, and before he's Alec Guinness in A New Hope, being very arch but also earnest. And in this midpoint, he's kind of this broken man. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this. And Haley, starting with you, I want to hear your take on the return of Ewan McGregor.
So, okay, like, he's a very good actor. And so he's like, he's selling it. I don't understand, in terms of the timeline, that he is still in this like place emotionally, like 10 years later. Like, it's 10 years, right? Or did I
read
that? Yeah, 10 years.
It feels like he would have, I don't know. I feel like he would have discovered that Anakin's still alive earlier than 10 years. And that, like, that's sort of confusing to me that it's taken this long, but I don't know. That's my main quibble about it. The rest of it, I feel like it's good. It's still annoying, though, just having seen him at his, like, peak. It's like, no, you can beat him in a fight. Like, fight, yeah. Darth Vader. You can win. You have won. But obviously that's part of the story, you know? And you just have to, and I'm sure it's like a comeback. Like, he'll get his swagger back and we'll get to that point where he's comfortable using the Force again, even while he remains in hiding. But I don't know. My main question is, as we all know on this podcast, I'm obsessed with the food of Star Wars. I want to know what that little, like, meat sliver he was bringing to his space camel every day was, and, like, what that job was. Has he been, like, carving up a giant desert fish for 10 years? Like, is that his job? And am I interpreting what that job is incorrectly?
Like, no, that, like, seems like it was
a giant desert fish.
Yeah, that seems like
Eric,
that
what did you think that job was?
I think that's exactly what it was. I think he's like
a desert fish miner,
or just desert lizard or something. I mean, some kind
meat
of creature
packer.
Yeah, I
want to eat it. I really want to try it.
It does look delicious.
I just like that he's, like, saving a piece for his EOP. I like seeing the thoughtful and caring side of Obi-Wan, even in this situation where
I thought he was getting it in trouble. I thought he was stealing that food.
He is stealing that food. And
every time I was like, he's going to get in trouble. But he didn't. And maybe, has he been doing that for 10 years?
I mean, I don't know. I don't think we have a great indication of how long this particular routine has lasted, but we know that it's lasted at least long enough for him to sort of feel out the rhythms of it.
Yeah.
I do agree with you, Grace, that it's interesting to see him at this point, at this low moment, because we're so used to, especially recently, because the Ewan Obi-Wan and also the James Arnold Taylor Obi-Wan, those are the most recent portrayals that we've seen. That's, I don't know, the vast majority of the Obi-Wan content we've ever gotten is the prequel version of Obi-Wan. So it's ambitious and risky to show us a person who is broken, who has basically given up, as he tells that fugitive Jedi, we lost. And it's really ambitious and risky, as I said, to show Obi-Wan saying, we lost, give up, go home, because that's not the Obi-Wan we're used to. But I think what the show is asking us to think about is, if you had 10 years to dwell on a failure of that scale, wouldn't you become disillusioned to this degree? I mean, it's hard for us to put out of our mind what we know is eventually going to happen with the resurgence of the light side and ultimately the victory, the temporary victory of the light side. But we have to sort of remember that Obi-Wan doesn't know about any of that. And from his perspective, it's game over. There's nothing left. I mean, he's watching over Luke. Someday, hopefully, Luke will be able to do something. But that's all speculative. And there's no certainty there. And this is Obi-Wan grappling with the fact that, at least for the foreseeable future, there isn't going to be any hope. And I really like that. I really like seeing that version of him, and I want to see where it goes. I like the fact that he hasn't fought in a while. He hasn't used the Force in a while. These are not things that come naturally to him anymore. He struggles to protect Leia from falling into the alley. I mean, using the Force is a struggle for him in that moment. I like that. I think that's really interesting. A lot of the Star Wars storytelling in this era from the expanded universe, some of the stories, if they touch on Obi-Wan, it's him kind of being he's more active in those stories. And this presents a picture of what if he didn't get involved because he knew he couldn't risk it, and his Force skills and his combat skills atrophied like this. It's really interesting, and I think it's very impressive.
I think I am more on the side with Eric here, although I do see where Haley is coming from. I like that idea of basically being broken down and seeing his routine. I think it was really good in the first episode that they did his routine not once, not twice, but three times. We saw his sad little space meatpacking routine, and I think that was important to establish what this character has made himself in order to survive. And you get into the headspace where you think, okay, if you had to live as a hermit in self-imposed exile on a sad desert planet and you couldn't use your powers, like, yeah, wouldn't you also become a sad, broken man? Or woman, as it were. So I do see that. But even at the same time, there is the little part of me that's like, okay, but in 5 years, he kills Maul in 2 seconds flat. So how do we get from the Obi-Wan of Obi-Wan Kenobi show to that? And I think that this show is very much how Obi-Wan got his groove back. But as Haley said, Ewan McGregor is just such a good actor. When he is on the verge of having a panic attack in episode 2 after learning that Anakin is alive, like, yeah, that's a dude who's about to have a panic attack. I very much recognize that. And I think that he's just done a really good job of demonstrating all of those complex emotions and those fears, even though it doesn't necessarily feel intuitive or natural to me as a viewer for the reasons that Eric laid out. I mean, he's doing such a good job with it that it is overcoming any of my hesitations.
The other thing about Rebels is, I mean, if you think about that episode, Twin Suns, you know, he's not like this super confident, like, dude with a lot of swagger in that episode. He doesn't whip out an incredibly sophisticated, like, lightsaber move to kill Darth Maul. It's not this giant battle. It's very consciously, like, this man who doesn't want to have to kill this character. But he will. He recognizes that it's necessary, and he does it in a very, the movement of it is very restricted and confined and almost clunky in a way, and yet still elegant. And I think that there's good continuity from this. I don't think that future version of Obi-Wan is inconsistent with what we're seeing here. I don't think that he needs to have some complete personality change or headspace change to become that version of Obi-Wan, because I think that person is still very much, he's not necessarily broken, but he isn't the confident Obi-Wan of episode 3 anymore. He's come to a realization, an acceptance, and perhaps we'll see him come to that acceptance in this show. But even if we don't, I think it's a natural evolution of having more time to think about things, particularly after this adventure. I can totally see him reaching the point where he has come to terms more with what has happened. And when Maul presents himself, he's like, okay, I don't want to fight you, but I need to clean this up because I have a kid I'm protecting. And that's, I think, the attitude that he takes into it.
I think if I would make a counterpoint to that, to the extent that he is in a totally different place than at that point in Rebels, it's like a religious one. And we've seen that in this show where he's like almost like praying to the Force, like trying to talk to Qui-Gon Jinn. And yeah, like he's totally like disconnected from the Force. And like they're like, oh, that old, like it was viewed as a religion, the Jedi, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know. There have been several scenes where he's out here looking like Jesus and he's like praying to Qui-Gon Jinn. But when I watched the Maul scene, that is a guy so attuned to the Force that like he doesn't even need to think about it. He doesn't need to deal with the fight. Like he just, it's over. Like he just deals with it. And so I like when I watch those things, I think, you know, that is the character evolution that we would see. Not so much, oh, I'm back and ready to do things and I, you know, have more energy and I'm ready. Like, no, I think it's more like he has, like you said, Eric, maybe come more to terms with things or accepted things, but also sort of back in alignment with in a religious sense.
I think that's a great way to put it.
Well, and speaking of Qui-Gon, I mean, I think if you want to think about where is the show going to take Obi-Wan that can put him on the path to being the Obi-Wan of Rebels, I think that we are in very good shape for a Qui-Gon Jinn voice cameo by Liam Neeson here. I mean, I you don't set up the idea of Obi-Wan trying to reach out to Qui-Gon at the beginning of this journey if you're not going to have it pay off with him reaching a point of accomplishment and mental discipline and quiet that he's able to finally make that connection with Qui-Gon in a way that is able to center him and provide him with that balance. I mean, we know that for Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon is a steadying presence in the prequel trilogy. And if you want to know how he gets to that version of himself in Rebels, I think it's going to happen with a Qui-Gon cameo, and that's going to be the implication of it is going to be that they continue to talk after that to some degree, and that is able to help Obi-Wan either get closure as Qui-Gon basically tells him this wasn't your fault, or you know he learns some new technique for steadying himself. I mean, I think that's where we're ultimately headed,
and that prepares him for in A New Hope. Where like his plot is, I'm done in the material realm. Like mm-hmm. like he knows that sort of taking Luke on that journey, when he fought Vader, like that was not a fight. Like he was ready to be the Force ghost. So I maybe to the extent that you know, Qui-Gon Jinn is part of this story, it's sort of learning how a former master can sort of come back and still play a role. Maybe it's sort of playing into that plot a little bit.
I really want to talk about the kind of crux of the show, it seems, from the third episode. But even before Vader shows up, the show really establishes that Anakin is haunting Obi-Wan. And I think that the relationship between the two of them is, as it was the beating heart of the prequels, I think that it really is the crux of the show, and so important to see the relationship between them as it plays out in this new phase. And I admit, I am a skeptic of them interacting at all, but I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on Vader and the confrontation that we saw in the third episode.
Haley, you want to go first?
I feel like you're gonna have a lot more thoughts on this, Eric, so that's probably a good idea. I liked it. I did. Okay, I'm a total wimp. I did not like that Vader randomly killed a little boy. I did not like that at all.
Classic Haley.
It was a little bit violent for me, and I will this is my biggest critique. The show is a little more like violent than the other ones. I feel like just in the sense that, like, people are obviously and, like, irreparably dying. which I, like, it's Star Wars, so I can't really complain.
Wars is in the title.
I can't really complain. And the, like, the Vader entrance was cool, but that's my biggest complaint about the Vader-Obi-Wan showdown was that moment. I really don't have a problem with the fire stopping Darth Vader from getting Obi-Wan. I don't, like, I know that there's people online who are very bothered by that as, like, a plot hole or something, but I don't really care. I thought it was good that it wasn't, like, a super elaborate lightsaber duel, just in keeping with where Obi-Wan is at. Like if we're committed to the plot where he has not fought in 10 years and he hasn't been using the Force, like, it's good they didn't just jump to, like, the most choreographed, elaborate lightsaber duel of all time. It was, you know, interesting to sort of see Obi-Wan. Oh, and Darth Vader was so scary when he just, like, randomly popped up from behind. Like, I don't know. I liked that. I liked sort of the suspense of it. I feel like that it was done well.
You know, Haley, if they'd been on Tatooine, they could have just brought the people in the village could have just brought all those dead people to the mod parlor and just, like, stitched them back up and given them, like, robot body parts and stuff. So
no.
it's really a shame that this is not happening on Tatooine, because the mod parlor would be able to just fix them right
not.
Back up.
Why would you remind me of that?
I like the idea that, like, in the background of every scene in any Star Wars project are just the survivors, like, quietly collecting the bodies and bringing them to Tatooine. And then, like, we later see those same characters, but just, like, with robot eyes or whatever. Just they're all going to the mod parlor. The mod parlor is the hottest club in Star Wars now. It's got everything. Okay, I'm not going to try to do Stefan. Yeah, I think I have a lot to say, but I'll keep it brief. I think, you know, as I think it was probably Grace who put it in the show notes, which is Darth Vader is a singular character in entertainment and one of the hardest characters to portray. And part of that is, how do you bring him in? What is the introduction? You'll never top showing up on the Tantive IV in A New Hope, but how do you try to emulate that thematically? And this show understands that Darth Vader needs to be dope. He needs to have a dope introduction. He needs to show up on the scene, and you need to not just visually recognize that it's Darth Vader, but you need to feel in your bones that it's Darth Vader. And this show did that. I mean, from the brief shot at the end of episode 2 to the beginning montage toward the beginning of episode 3 to when he actually shows up on the scene on the planet. As Haley said, you know, the spookiness of that confrontation when Vader then just sort of suddenly shows up behind him. I mean, Ewan McGregor has said that when they filmed that scene, he had a moment of pure real terror seeing Vader come at him. I won't say unexpectedly, but you know, in a sort of surprising moment. And that's a testament to how well that was executed from a writing perspective and also a cinematography perspective, that this is a very good job of a very difficult task of making of giving us just enough of Darth Vader and in just the right way that he still has that mystique, that mythos of who Darth Vader is. It's very easy to overuse him if you get obsessed with the idea that this is Darth Vader and we've got to make the most of him, but you've got to do it sparingly, and this show gets that.
Yeah, I am the exact opposite of Haley. Because I really liked the violence. I mean, you know, obviously not a fan of snapping necks in real life, it must be said.
it does. It's okay. You don't need to say that.
Okay. I didn't want you to think I was a psychopath. But I think that just having him be so menacing and just straight up arriving on the scene and murdering people very clearly. Like, that's a villain. And Darth Vader is one of the most iconic villains of all time. And it is easy to overuse him. And I'm worried and hoping that the show doesn't overuse him. But in this episode, I feel like they really nailed it, as Eric was saying. It reminded me of the iconic scene in Rogue One, where he turns on his lightsaber in the darkness, and the lightsaber is the first thing you see of him, and then he just straight up murders a bunch of rebels, and it's terrifying and visceral, but it's also, there's just something so delicious about watching a really good villain. And I think that the final scenes of this episode nailed it. And especially too with him dragging Obi-Wan through the flames. That's a very visceral thing to do. Of, you know, you burned me, I'm burning you, literally. And I think that it was just really well done. But also that in particular highlighted the emotional stakes that underpinned the whole thing, where Obi-Wan is really running away from what he feels like he did. He thought he killed his friend, and now his friend is a monster, and his friend just told him, "You made me a monster." And so Obi-Wan is running away, as any rational person would be, from this terrifying creature, but also knowing that the terrifying creature is someone that you love. I think that the show really did a good balance of having the cinematography, the choreography, just the scariness of Darth Vader, coupled with the very real emotions underpinning all of it. And that's really what made it sing to me.
Yeah, so a few things. First of all, I don't care that he didn't walk around the flames to get to Obi-Wan. I think, you know, this is his first confrontation with Obi-Wan, obviously, it's just as it's Obi-Wan's first confrontation with him since Mustafar. And so there's emotion, even for Vader. This is still a moment where he's not fully in control, in the sense that he is being distracted or affected by his emotions. And so he's not operating in that sort of, at least when it comes to Obi-Wan, he's not the same kind of ruthless, deliberate person that he was earlier, walking down that street and just casually killing people on his walk, that sort of relentless Darth Vader that we know. When he gets to Obi-Wan, there's a difference there. You can tell that just as Obi-Wan is thrown off balance by Vader, Vader still has that lingering sense of emotional connection to Obi-Wan. And I'm not saying that he like doesn't want to kill Obi-Wan. I'm saying just it's a complicated moment for him. And so he's not necessarily thinking with the same kind of precision and farsightedness that he would be otherwise. And so in that moment when Obi-Wan gets away and there are the flames there that probably remind him of Mustafar, that's just an overwhelming moment for him. And I'm totally fine with that being the explanation of why he doesn't do what any of us think we might do if we were in that situation. I also just think, you know, sort of related to that, you can tell that while Vader, especially at this point, is a very reserved and quiet figure around pretty much everybody, Obi-Wan is sort of that one final person who can draw out his obsessiveness and almost his immaturity, his need for revenge. That's not a very cold and calculating thing, which is what we normally associate with Vader. This is the one person that he will really just do anything to make him feel the pain that Obi-Wan made him feel. And so, yeah, I mean, he's been fantasizing about burning Obi-Wan alive for 10 years, and it's this raw kind of, again, almost immature desire to cause pain that I think shows a different kind of Vader than what we're used to from this era. Because there is still that Anakin fall into the dark side version of Anakin inside the suit. It's not just that cold, implacable Vader that we know from the original trilogy. It is still partly the pre-suit, pre-Mustafar Vader, the Hayden Christensen Vader. There's still some of that in here that is just obsessed with destroying Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan is the one person who can get him to act that way. And it's, again, not a side of Vader that we're used to seeing, but it's a reminder that at this time in galactic history, that part of Anakin slash Vader is still in there.
I think it's also important to mention that James Earl Jones is once again voicing Vader, and that his voice is just such an iconic element of the Darth Vader persona that I think that is a very key to having the character really just be the full Vader, while also, as Eric is saying, have that Anakin underside to him. I do have to get something off my chest, which is that I don't know how this is going to work, because in A New Hope, Vader very specifically says, the last time we met, I was the learner and you were the master, and now I'm the master. And it's just, I don't understand how they were able to meet again in this interim period and have it still keep with the continuity. I mean, I'm trying to get there, but that is my biggest sticking point.
Maybe he was thinking about that line for a while and he just wanted to use it. Or he forgot, or he has like a concussion at some point and doesn't remember having met Obi-Wan at this sort of mid period. There are ways to get around it.
So the line, I looked up the script, and the line is, when I left you, I was but the learner. Now I'm the master. Now, I am also one of those people who did not want to see this confrontation. I forgot to kind of write this in our notes, but I think it is important to point out, is I didn't want to see this confrontation. I did want A New Hope to be their first confrontation, because I think the most natural and intuitive meaning of that line is the last time we saw each other. But technically he does say, when I left you, which I think if you do want to parse it, it's reasonable to read that as when I became Darth Vader and left the Jedi Order, when we separated as brothers. So that would be, I think, the explanation that they're going with. That being said, I didn't want this story point to happen. I have to admit that on a technical level, it was executed very well. You know, as we were saying earlier, it's not Battle of the Heroes Part 2, right? It's not that duel on Mustafar. It is, what would these two people actually be able to do? Particularly, you know, Vader is not a spring chicken either, right? Vader is not jumping around the way that Anakin was, and I don't think that we will see that in Star Wars. We haven't seen it yet. So it's just a reminder that, like, they're both broken in a way. And so I like the execution of it. I'm still not sure that it was worth it from a story perspective to insert this meeting before the A New Hope one, but that is kind of the explanation that I think they would give, is that if you parse the dialogue, it does leave room for this.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much exactly how I feel, which is I didn't necessarily want this. It is being executed extremely well so far, but I'm still hesitant about it because of that. And I would also point out that in the quote, he doesn't just say, when I left you, he also says, the circle is complete, which again implies that the last time they met was as apprentice and master. But we're just like parsing dialogue now, which is the most annoying thing.
Well, I will say I'm very interested in that one moment where Obi-Wan thinks that he sees Anakin as, you know, Hayden Christensen in the Jedi robes Anakin. And there's debate online about, is he hallucinating? Is Vader force projecting himself to distract Obi-Wan and throw him off balance? We know that you can do that and present yourself in a different way than you actually look. We've seen that in Last Jedi. So, I mean, I think that's really interesting. I really do want to see more of Hayden, where we get to see his face. Whichever one of those explanations it is, I think just taking Obi-Wan off balance like that by reminding him of, like, this is the life that you used to have. This is the promise of that guy, that kid, and it's gone now. I think that's just really a compelling thing to do from a story perspective. I love that line. I am what you made me. I mean, I think that one thing that it's easy to overlook, that he is not proud of himself. He's criticizing Obi-Wan. He's saying, where I am right now is your fault, right? He's not happy with where he is, even if he acknowledges that it is what's best for him. In a sense, it's necessary to bring order to the galaxy. He's not happy with who he is, and I like that we're seeing that to some degree. So maybe we should talk a little bit, you know, in the time we have left, there's a lot of other ground that we could cover, but we do need to talk about the other main villain of Obi-Wan Kenobi, the Inquisitor Reva, and the role that she plays here, I think is very interesting. There's a lot of questions about what is she to Obi-Wan? Is this purely about just destroying a famous Jedi, or do they have some connection? I would love to hear what you thought, Grace, about her role in the story, and just more broadly kind of what it says about the Inquisitors at this point in the story, and how they use her.
Well, my theory is that she was one of the younglings that we see in the beginning, in Order 66, when we see that carried out and the younglings escaping. I think that she was one of those, and I do think that there is some sort of background there with the Jedi. I think that she is a great villain. I think the actress Moses Ingram has a lot of natural charisma, and there's just this really great swagger to her. I personally am a huge fan of her taking lots of unnecessary leaps and twirls, because that's the Jedi way. Those are, and the Sith way, they are some dramatic folks. They always do a twirl when they don't need to do a twirl. And I respect leaning into that.
They're very extra.
Yes, they're extremely extra. And she was kind of overshadowed in the third episode, I thought, by the larger conflict between Vader and Obi-Wan. So I'm hoping that we get some of her menacing presence more in future episodes, particularly as she has this confrontation with Leia. But so far, I mean, I'm a big fan of her.
Yeah, I love this ambitious person who is not willing to wait her turn, and the kind of, yeah, whatever happens with her relationship or connection to Obi-Wan, I think she's a great addition to the story. I'm very interested in seeing what's next for her.
Yeah, I think she's done a great job. Sort of what you said, Eric, in terms of ambitious, like, you know, people like her who are like, I'm getting what I deserve. It's like just pure, like, I don't know, pridefulness, like revenge, anger, which is like very dark side. So I to the extent that I have hopes for that character, it's like when we find out whatever happened to make her this way. I don't know. I hope there's a little more depth, which they're hinting at depth, you know, like they're hinting that there's some reason behind the way she's so intense. So I don't know. I'm looking forward to finding out what that is.
Yeah, I just like that she comes from, you know, the streets, basically, and has had to prove herself in, and is continuing to have to prove herself in a way that the other Inquisitors have not. Which, you know, as we go through kind of the last little bits of these episodes here, let's talk very briefly about the Grand Inquisitor. I was obviously not a fan of the fact that his head does not look like it should based on Star Wars Rebels. He is stabbed pretty nastily at the end of episode 2. The dialogue at the beginning of episode 3 certainly implies that he's dead. But man, all I will say about that for now, because we have 3 more episodes, is I'm reserving judgment until I see what they do. I still, even after all the things that they've done, cannot believe that they would contradict Rebels like this by killing this character off before any of his stories play out in Rebels. But we'll see what they do. Some have suggested that maybe that's a completely different Grand Inquisitor, and maybe that explains the head thing. I don't know, maybe, but man, they gotta figure that out, or they're going to have an angry podcast host, which I know they definitely don't want.
I sort of liked the boldness of hyping up that guy and then he just dies like 2 episodes in. I don't know. I sort of would like to see it stick instead of always resurrecting people after they die.
They could take him to the mod parlor. I mean, yeah. That's, I guess, one
he
explanation.
He could be on Tatooine right now.
And that's why his head is stretched in Rebels. Yeah, that's my
He got a head transplant.
That's my one complaint, is that he was a pretty boring character in Obi-Wan Kenobi show. But if they mess with the continuity of Rebels, that they will not just have one very angry podcast host. They will have two very angry podcasts.
Oh, you don't want that, Lucasfilm. I mean, you just don't want that. No, I don't think they're going to figure it out. I mean, they're not like Rebels. The things that they have like lightly contradicted already are not on that same scale as Rebels in terms of just in the pantheon of like authoritative Star Wars stories. So they'll figure it out. I did see one funny tweet that was like, "We were able to revive you, sir, but we had to put you in the head stretcher." So maybe we'll see something like that. Yeah, listen, they've got three more episodes. In the next episode, we're going to be talking about it one way or the other, and they're either going to have two angry hosts or zero angry hosts, and I certainly hope it's zero. Let's talk briefly about Owen. We haven't gotten to see Beru yet. We know we will, but I was just really impressed with Joel Edgerton's depiction of Owen and, again, bridging the gap between what little we see of him in Ep 3, or I guess Ep 2, and then very briefly in Ep 3, and then the Owen of Episode 4, you can see that he really resents having Obi-Wan around, and that he understands that he has a responsibility here, and in a sense, Obi-Wan is just making it harder. Did that stand out to either of you in terms of that character, the characterization, really, and showing that transition?
Yes, and it goes to my other point about why Obi-Wan is just hanging out there for 10 years, not doing anything. And we're sort of seeing that contrast to, what's the lady's name? Who's like their contact trying to help them escape.
The fake Imperial officer.
Yes.
I forget her name, but her. Indira Varma is the actress. Yeah.
She is sort of, I don't know, her character contrasts. Like, I feel like Obi-Wan and her had a conversation, right, where they talked about like, why are you like risking your life or something like that, and she's like, oh, I need to help people. Maybe I made up that conversation in my head, but it seems like it's almost making Obi-Wan think about like, how could I still keep Luke safe, still not, you know, be identified by the Empire, and, you know, live by the Jedi code and not be like totally underground and ignoring everyone and just a total hermit. I don't know. It just sort of, to me, is like a contrast. Like there are people actively fighting the Empire. Like there are people actively helping fugitives and resisting. And I'm pretty sure both of you saw the tweet that it's like there's this generation of people who are just like waiting for the younger generation to grow up and fix their problems for them. And like, I know that's the plot, but I just feel like Obi-Wan should do more. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that was a real conversation. I don't think you made it up. And I think she also says something like she joined the Empire and then realized what was really happening and decided, yeah, that she needed to help. And I do think you're right that there is this contrast between her and Obi-Wan, and with Owen being like, you're basically useless and you're just putting us in danger, and get your cheap toy away from my nephew. And it's like, we're supposed to think he's being harsh, but you know, he got a point. And I think also, like, we were just talking about how Brea and Bale really influenced Leia. I think in the scene where we see Owen face down against Reva and really stand his ground and not betray at all what he knows about Obi-Wan or Luke, I think that really shows his strength of character and how, you know, he may be dealing with this nephew that he never thought he'd have to deal with, but that's his family, and he's going to protect his family. And so I think that was, even if it wasn't intended that way, it was another nice little insight into the home life of Luke and Leia pre A New Hope.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I loved the, like, Underground Railroad of Star Wars, like, this idea that there are these sort of non-Force users who remember the Jedi, appreciate the Jedi, do what they can to help them. It's this interesting reversal of power where the Jedi need to be protected now. They need to be ferried, you know, from safe house to safe house. And I love that element, that introduction of that concept in episode three. And you know, since we're talking about that, there's an Easter egg there. Obi-Wan, you know, reads something on the wall, and he says, you know, Quinlan was here, which is this nice reference to Quinlan Vos, who originated in the expanded universe, was referenced in episode three, was actually going to appear in the Order 66 sequence in episode three, was cut at the last minute, and then went on to have other stories after Revenge of the Sith. I love that they are hinting at the other characters and situations from this broader universe. I love that they're giving us those little Easter eggs. It's an example of a way to do it that's not intrusive, that allows you to just get it out and move the story along.
One of these days, it's going to be like, Galeric was here, and they're one of talking to him.
One of these days, yes, if you hear just a shout across Washington, D.C., you will know that you need to watch whatever, Andor or whatever the episode is.
Galeric someday. is central. I'm here. I've heard from sources. Central to the plot of Andor.
Can I just that would be hilarious, but the other funny Easter egg in here is so we haven't even talked about Kumail Nanjiani. I don't know that we need to spend a ton of time on him, but I thought that he was very funny, an example of a good way of sort of doing humor in the show without detracting from the seriousness. But the kid that he helps escape in episode two, if you look at the credits at the end of the episode, that character is named Corran. As in, famous expanded universe Jedi, Corran Horn. And there's a piece of writing on the wall in that Jedi safe house that says, I forget the guy's name, but whatever Corran Horn's dad's name is in the expanded universe, his birth name, that is written on the wall there. And so they're really trying to make Corran Horn happen, but as unobtrusive, it's like they're trying to do it for those of us who want to know that it's happening, but with plausible deniability. Like, nobody ever says Corran Horn in the episode, but it's written on the wall, it's in the credits. I see you, Lucasfilm. I see you, Deborah Chow. I see what you're doing. I appreciate it.
Eric, you see the writing on the wall?
I literally see the writing. I see the Ourobesh on the wall, okay? We're going to get a Corran Horn cameo. No, I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, for us who aren't, can you explain who Corran Horn is?
He's just one of those characters who was in a lot of books in the expanded universe and just developed a following. He's not, there's nothing like particularly, I don't know, I'm going to get the Corran Horn lovers after me, but like, there's nothing particularly notable about him. He's just, he is present throughout a lot of the storytelling in the sort of post Return of the Jedi era of the expanded universe. He's in a lot of books. He goes through a lot of stuff. He's, you know, friends with Luke and all that stuff. And he's just one of those guys that it's apparently fun for the creators of current Star Wars to reference him. And I appreciate that. I appreciate the little Easter egg there.
The last thing I want to talk about is the naked mole rat Imperialist loyalist truck driver.
Oh my gosh. It was so well done, though.
So like, well done.
Oh my word.
There's nothing wrong with a little order.
And you know what? I like that we're seeing that. Frankly, it would be silly if we didn't see that at some point in this era, because a lot of people feel that way. I mean, this is realistic, is that this is why the Empire is able to survive, ultimately. It's not just about the spaceships. It's about, not everybody is in revolt. A lot of people are just going about their lives, and they like what the Empire is doing. And I thought it was nice to introduce him as just a friendly dude, and we're on his side. And then we realize, oh, we're not on his side.
Yeah, I thought it was really nicely done in terms of world building, in terms of having a fun little alien creature. but definitely, I mean, that's how it goes. There's a reason why the line, we all know my favorite line, so this is how Liberty die, was with thunderous applause. Like, that thunderous applause isn't just in the Senate, it's among the people too.
Yeah.
And you can totally see how an ordinary space trucker would be very approving of the Empire and what it's doing and want to do his civic duty. So I loved that little detail. And just always having new alien species really entertains me, especially alien species with practical effects. So shout out to that guy. He was great, not as a person, but as a character.
The last thing I will say is, if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I did get to see the first two episodes at the world premiere on Thursday night at Star Wars Celebration in Anaheim. And I cannot recommend highly enough going to one of these events, not necessarily to see a sneak peek at a new TV show, although that was very cool, but just to be in a room with a bunch of Star Wars fans who all pretty much love the same things you do, have the same reactions that you do, and to watch something on the screen together and to have that moment of reaction. I mean, they start this entire thing off with, you know, the shot of Coruscant, and my friend, who's a huge Coruscant fan, is sitting next to me, and he goes, "Oh my God, that's Coruscant." And they pull back, and suddenly we're in the Jedi Temple. Oh, this is nice. A nice little training session. This is very interesting. And then the door opens, and you realize what day it is. And, like, to start with that and just have that, I mean, you don't have time to catch your breath. Everybody in the room is freaking out because it's slowly dawning on them what this is. And to witness that together makes the scene more emotional because you're getting the reaction that you're having. It's being multiplied and amplified around you. There's nothing like that. And the same with Leia. I mean, when, you know, the first time you see Alderaan, it's like, oh, Alderaan, wow, I wonder what's going on here. And then you see the royal attendants lifting the cloak into place and you see the little shoes. And, you know, I mean, people were losing their minds. I mean, there was like audible gasping and crying around me because it's like, this is happening and you're all witnessing it at the same time. And, you know, a lot of people had to rewatch that episode later that night because they missed a lot of stuff because their brains went blank when they saw that. And so I wanted to just give a little shout out to Star Wars Celebration for giving me the opportunity to be in a room with a bunch of people who were experiencing all that together in person at the same time, because that really for me amplified that experience, and I cannot wait to have that experience again. All right, and that's going to bring our look at the first three episodes of Obi-Wan Kenobi to an end. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you do want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest things that we should talk about in future episodes, please do email us, hothtakes@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We are hothtakes on Twitter. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers on Twitter. And Haley is Burdenator. Haley made our wonderful logo and banner art. I edited this episode. I also put together our music, although again, for legal purposes, we do want to point out that all Star Wars themes are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website. That's hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hot Takes on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We will see you next time. May the Force be with you.